Aloha, Jeff Davis, the solar guy here. A breath of fresh air is what you need on your afternoon drive home, not the boring windbags. Can I say that? Tune in Monday through Friday. That's Lice Tomorrow, 5 to 6 p.m., 760 KGU. Aloha.
Jeff Davis, the Solar Guy, presents Hawaii's Tomorrow, a series of discussions about Hawaii's business future, led by experts in their respective fields. Today's contributing host is the man himself, Jeff Davis, the Solar Guy.
Aloha. I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal and the program manager for Kosi Island Earth. On this Tuesday, February 19th, we are going to go deep. Deep sea, that is, with some of the University of Hawaii's leading marine scientists exploring ocean depths rarely searched. Here with us today is oceanography professor Dr. Jeff Drazen and his student, PhD candidate Anella Choi. We also have with us today Rachel Orange and Dr. John Wiltshire from the Hawaii Undersea Research Laboratory. Calling in at the end of the show today will be Dr. Craig Smith, professor in the Department of Oceanography as well. Today's show has been made possible by the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology and Hawaii's new COSI program, Island Earth. COSI stands for Centers for Ocean Science and Education Excellence and is an NSF-funded program. We have a jam-packed show for you, so let's start. Without further ado, Anella Choi is a PhD candidate, as I mentioned, at the Department of Oceanography at UH Manoa. So, Anella, tell us, what got you interested in your research, and tell us a little bit about what you do.
Okay. Well, growing up in Hawaii gave me a really easy reason to be interested in the ocean. All things in it, waves, living things. And when I got older and finished college, I got really interested in marine science topics that are really close to the people of Hawaii, things like commercial fishing and contaminants in our ocean. So those things have been kind of the focus of my PhD research.
And what type of tools do you use to study those subjects?
Well, kind of the focus of my work is on understanding the open ocean food web around Hawaii. And that's a food web is basically the kind of framework that all the animals in the ocean fit into, and how they're all connected by feeding relationships. So I try to use a pretty diverse toolbox. And that includes really tried and true things like looking inside fish stomachs and counting and identifying all the different prey items in there. And a lot of different modern tools, more biochemical things like looking at the natural abundances of certain things like isotopes and fatty acids. So these are naturally occurring elements in animals, and they can tell us a lot of different things. For example, what an animal might have been eating recently, or where it was foraging, or where does it fit into the bigger context of the open ocean ecosystem.
And studying those stomach contents, have you found anything really surprising or interesting?
Yeah, well, it's a really interesting experience every time you open up a big fish stomach. Doesn't usually smell very good. It also often looks pretty gross. But you find a lot of really fascinating deep sea animals in there that you probably wouldn't get to see otherwise. You find things with really big teeth and big eyes and dark skin. And one thing we've found recently in some ongoing diet studies has been a large prevalence of plastic or, you know, anthropogenic debris in these fish stomachs. And it's been really surprising because these are big fish that swim great distances. They dive really deep, and they live very far offshore from land masses, and there's a surprising amount of plastic in their stomachs.
In your research, are you taking note of that plastic content, or are you keeping track of it?
Yeah, so we're working on a paper that quantifies and kind of talks exclusively about this topic. And it's a really interesting topic because traditionally you think of plastic as being this really floaty, buoyant material. Lots of people talk about it being found at the surface of the ocean, lots of visual observations. But we're finding it in you know, deep sea fish. And so it suggests that it's kind of gotten deeper down into the ocean, this whole plastic pollution.
So I guess that brings me to my next question. In the type of fish you're studying a lot of fish that we find in the deep sea. What type of fish are there, and how does that relate to what you do?
So these are all open ocean fish, and we call them mesopelagic, meaning they live in the middle layers of the water column. And this is a really low-light environment, low food, low shelter. And I think people might be surprised that a lot of these fish are actually on their dinner table. They're things like opa, the moonfish, sickle pomfret or the monchong, escalar, people might know as the oilfish or walu. So they have a lot of relevance to people and, you know, the people that eat them every day.
And are you concerned about the safety of eating these deep sea fish if we're finding all kinds of plastics and stuff in their stomach contents?
I'm not particularly personally concerned, but there is a lot of literature and discussion out there surrounding some of these issues. And there's a lot of unknowns and a lot more work to be done. But there is some people that have hypothesized, you know, the transference of chemicals from plastic into fish tissue. Some people are concerned about high mercury levels. So there's a lot of concern.
And you also look at trace elements as well found in the fish. And so what kind of data or results are you getting with that?
So these are really trace elements like carbon and nitrogen. We look at the stable isotopes of them, and they can tell us, as I was saying earlier, you know, what the fish has been eating more or less, and what place in the food web do they have. So we've been finding some really interesting results that basically say that surface water communities are really, they might be really tied to deeper water communities. And that's something that folks in our community have talked about for a long time. But we're kind of finding some new biochemical evidence for that.
And so how far along are you with your research? Is there further work to be done once you're finished with your PhD?
Yeah, there's always a lot of work to be done. I'm kind of in the writing stages right now and hope to be finishing up within the year.
Well, congratulations on
that.
Thank you. And so we're going to be talking to Dr. Drazen next. And how does your work complement what he does?
So Jeff does a lot of things, which I'm sure he'll tell you about. But I think he's a very big picture type of guy, and this fits into basic ecology, food webs, how do they all fit together, and how is everything connected in the ocean. So, yeah.
And do you have one particular deep sea fish that you like to study or that you'd like to narrow your research focus on later on?
I think they're all really interesting, but I really like the opa, the moonfish. I don't know if you've ever seen it. If you haven't seen it, go down to the fish auction at Pier 38. It's a big, beautiful deep-sea fish, really brightly colored, silver and red, and it has these funny-looking lips, kind of like a person. And it's just a silly-looking fish, and it's really interesting.
And so the fish that you study, are you getting them live, or do you get them from the fish market?
Yeah, we get some of them from the fish market. A lot of the guys down there are really generous with letting us come in and sample stomachs from some of the fish. And we also get fish from the longline observers that are aboard all of the commercial vessels. They're really great. They help us sample stomachs, and we get some whole fish from them. But they're not. None of them are live. They're all frozen.
Well, that sounds like really interesting work, and I'm so happy you were able to share a little bit about what you do with us. Thanks for being here. We're going to take a traffic break, and when we come back, we're going to go deeper into our deep sea exploration. I'd like to give a shout out to some of the Solar Guy sponsors: R&R Solar and Rolf Chris, Kona Red, Edible Hawaiian Islands, Inter Island Solar Supply in Kali Judd, and Natural Energy Laboratory.
760 KGU.
Part of the Wall Street Business Network.
Other than some wet roads, no problems reported to the windward side this afternoon on the Pali, the Likelike, or the H3. Going east, looks good to Hawaii Kai. Inbound traffic from the east slows at the old Waialae Road overpass. If you're going west from town, the H1 slows at the airport on-ramp overpass on the viaduct, and the Moanalua slows at the Fort Shafter overpass. Inbound traffic from the west slows when you get to Middle Street.
The sun is the root source of energy in food, fossil fuels, and wind energy. The clearest use of the sun's energy is solar power. BanQu Solar brings to Hawaii a technological breakthrough that maximizes the power from each solar module with our AC Unison system. BanQ Solar's AC Unison modules have microinverters on each module that converts DC electricity to AC electricity, allowing your system to produce 5 to 25% more power than other solar systems. It's cost-effective, has a 25-year warranty, and an attractive all-black design. The AUO BanQ Solar Company is one of the most trusted companies in the solar industry. With state and federal incentives in place and utility rates going up, now is the time to generate your own electricity with a beautiful BanQ solar system. It looks great, produces more power than standard solar systems, and saves you money in the process. Call 554-7200 for your local BanQ solar installer and enjoy your savings now.
280,000 acres. That's the size of Molokai, Lanai, and Kahoolawe put together. It's also the amount of the prime farmable ag land designated in Hawaii. 280,000 acres. That's a lot of prime farmable ag land, and it needs to be preserved for agriculture. Aloha, I'm Dean Okimoto of Nalo Farms, and this fact is brought to you by Ho'opili, a new community where commercial farms, neighborhood, and home gardens will be part of the community's design. And there's so much more. Log on to www.ho'opili'oahu.com.
Over the past century, more than 90% of koa forests in Hawaii have disappeared as tropical hardwood prices have skyrocketed. Hawaii's koa forests are an important part of our ecosystem and a symbol of our island heritage. Hawaiian Legacy Hardwoods and Hawaii's Tomorrow need your help to repopulate 1,000 acres on the Big Island with new koa trees. For $60, you can sponsor your very own koa legacy tree on the slopes of Mauna Kea. Legacy trees can honor an individual, commemorate an event, or memorialize a loved one. Along with a beautifully engraved personalized certificate, $20 will also be donated to the charity or organization of your choice. Gift a gift that grows grander year after year. And see how simple the act of planting a tree can change the face of the planet. To plant your Hawaiian koa legacy tree, go to hawaiistomorrow.com and click on the legacy tree icon. Again, hawaiistomorrow.com. That's Hawaii's with an S, tomorrow.com.
Aloha, it's Jeff. Is it hotter in your home than out on your lanai? Do you wish there was an energy-efficient way to cool down? Wouldn't it be nice to turn on the trays at the flip of a switch? Well, my friends at Island Cooling have been quietly promoting the energy-efficient whole house fan for years. It works by drawing fresh air through your home, pushing the hot air out through your attic. Call the whole house fan experts at Island Cooling, 672-2300, 672-2300, or go to islandcooling.com. Aloha.
If you would like to join Jeff Davis and his guests on the air, call now at 296-5467. That's 296-5467. Now back to the Solar Guy.
You're listening to Hawaii's Tomorrow with Jeff Davis, the Solar Guy.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, filling in for Jeff Davis. With us now is Dr. Jeff Drazen, a professor of oceanography at the University of Hawaii, Manoa, who studies the ecology of deep sea fishes and their role in seafood webs. So, Jeff, let's start off. What is the deep sea?
Well, scientists debate about this, but I think that most would agree that the deep sea is that part of the ocean where there isn't enough light to support plants or algae. And so usually that cutoff is at about 600 feet. And the environment there is very different than what most of us are used to experiencing in shallow waters. It's pretty cold. It's dark, as I just mentioned, and it's under tremendous pressure. So every 10 meters you descend into the ocean, there's another atmosphere of pressure. So crushing pressures at great depths, and there isn't very much food there. So it's a very different habitat.
So it sounds a little dark and a little scary. What draws you to the deep sea, or what do you find intriguing about it?
Well, for starters, it's the single largest environment on our planet. About two-thirds of our globe is covered in waters that are greater than 600 feet deep, the deep sea. And just as an example of this, if you take a look at the Papahanaumokuakea Marine National Monument, the Northwest Hawaiian Islands, this is a one of the very largest reserves in the world. And if you take a look at that area, 85% of it has water depths greater than 2,000 meters. So only about 1.5% of that is the coral reefs. So it's a huge habitat that we really need to study, and that definitely has drawn me towards researching this environment.
Well, and that's interesting because most of the science you hear about, or most of the researchers, are more drawn to those shallow waters with the coral reefs and fish in those environments. And you don't hear too often about some of the deep sea research that's happening, or if it is even happening at all. I mean, I've heard somewhere that they say we know more about space than we do about the deep sea. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, it certainly is. Historically, I mean, even in the 1800s, there was a hypothesis put forth that there was no life in the deep sea, and this place was had not enough food, and that there was not enough oxygen, and there was no life below a depth of about 1,000 feet or so. And that was quickly proved wrong by this round-the-world expedition by the ship the Challenger, and they found life wherever they looked in the deep ocean. But it's been a difficult place to work because of those characteristics that I just mentioned. It's very hostile to us. We can't survive those crushing pressures. It's difficult to see in the dark. It's a hard place to study.
And so how do you overcome those challenges? What are you studying in the deep sea?
Well, we overcome those technological hurdles in a number of different ways. We've developed sensors that and instruments that can survive those crushing pressures. Camera systems are one such tool that I use quite a lot to look at deep sea communities. We have submarines that can dive to great depths, and we can use those and robotic arms on them to carry out experiments. We can do very simple things, too, and these are the kinds of things that have been done since that Challenger expedition that I mentioned. You can just take a net and drag it behind a boat, and you can catch a great deal of the life that lives in a particular place and study it and learn about what it eats, which is what my student Anella was talking about a few moments ago on the show, and look at the adaptations of those organisms to their environment.
So in the videos that you've looked at, is there anything that really surprises you about some of these organisms in the deep sea?
Well, there's a number of animals that have very bizarre shapes and forms that really are quite amazing. And it's hard to describe them, but imagine, for instance, an anglerfish, which is a fish that lives in the deep midwaters at depths of thousands of feet down. And it basically looks like a floating head. It has almost no body and tail, an enormous mouth with fang-like teeth, and a little lure dangling from its forehead the end of it can light up and blink on and off. So if you've ever seen the movie Finding Nemo, when the fish go down into the great depths, there is an anglerfish trying to eat them. These are the kinds of strange things that you find regularly in the deep sea. Almost every expedition we go on, we find a new species. So we've already described two new species of fish here in the Hawaiian Islands from just a couple of sampling trips in the last couple of years.
That's got to add to the excitement, the unknown and being able to find new species every time you go down there, or something new every time that you go out and do some exploration. Now, you also mentioned a little bit in your work about carbon sequestration. Can you tell us what that is exactly?
Well, this comes back to why it's important to study the deep ocean. Because the deep ocean is such an enormous, vast volume of water, it has a great capacity to store heat and to store carbon, and thus buffer climate changes. And we need to understand the processes in this system that control how it it can buffer heat and carbon. And carbon in particular, this relates back to food webs. Carbon sequestration is the process in which carbon dioxide in our atmosphere could be fixed by plants or algae, plankton floating in the ocean. And then when those animals die, they sink to the deep sea floor and they get buried in the sediments. And that takes that carbon out of the carbon cycle. It can remove it from the atmosphere for hundreds to millions of years. Ultimately, it can result in the production of oil for, you know, in the distant future.
So what is your biggest concern about the deep sea? Are you more concerned about discovering new things, or do you feel that this environment is under threat at all?
Well, I think most of my interest stems in understanding sort of the role that these organisms play in the food webs and in the structure of the communities in the deep sea. There are a lot of threats to the way these deep sea ecosystems function and the services that they can provide to us, and that comes from anything from the mining of mineral resources and fishing. Fishing is a big one. And also, historically, people have used the deep ocean as a dump. So if you go off the coast of Waianae, there is a vast field of old World War I and I think some World War II munitions scattered across the seafloor. So it's oftentimes been used as a place that's out of sight and thus out of mind. It can be a dumping ground. So,
and when you look at these food web connections, are you looking mostly at some of these larger fish that you find in the deep sea, or are there people like yourself or other people that are studying some of the smaller organisms found there?
We study both the small and the large organisms in my lab group. And it's interesting. A lot of the larger organisms are important to us because we harvest them for food. So orange roughy, Chilean sea bass, the OPA that Anella was speaking about are all examples of deep water fishes that can live as much as 3,000 or more feet down that we harvest for food. And some of the research that we've been doing in my lab group has been looking at their metabolism and in their growth rates and trying to understand whether or not these fishes can be managed the way we're used to managing shallow water fishes, shallow water stocks. And that's not the case. So very interestingly, when you get down into the cold dark of the deep sea, the pace of life slows down greatly. And we have measured the metabolism in a number of deep sea fishes, and it can be as much as 10 times slower as shallow living fish. So pace of life is very slow. And the research partly in my group, but mostly in other groups, has looked at growth. And some of these large deep water species can live as much as 100 to 150 years of age. And that means with such a slow pace of life that fishing for them must be done very, very carefully. So that's sort of the large side of things. But we also study a lot of the smaller organisms that live in the deep sea. And these often are important food for shallow water animals. So most of us like to eat sashimi and poke, and big eye tuna is one of the fishes that we harvest for that. It turns out that these animals dive to as much as 1,800 feet in depth and forage on deep water animals that live there. And it's important to understand this food web, and it's important to gain some better insight, both because the deep water animals are providing forage, but it turns out In one study, and this is something that my student Anella was working on, the little animals are where mercury enters the food web in the deep sea. And when these animals that we eat dive deep, that's where they get their mercury from.
So if you had to let the world know one important thing about the marine environment or the deep sea, what would that be?
That is a really hard question to answer because there are so many things that I feel that the public does not know about the deep sea. And I would say that the deep sea environment is very closely linked to us and to shallow water ecosystems, and we need a better appreciation of that.
Excellent. Thank you so much for being here with us today. Jeff, we really appreciate you taking the time to explain a little bit about what the deep sea is. We'll take a quick traffic break. I'd like to acknowledge some of our sponsors, Honolulu Weekly, Sabrina's Restaurant, Hawaii Nanotech Glass Coating, and Focused Energy.
KGU,
part of the Wall Street Business Network.
There are a couple of new accidents reported. One is on the H1 freeway eastbound at the McCulley Overpass. The other one is at Kinau and Pensacola. And also in Makiki, Lunalilo is slower than usual because of utility work. The right lane of Lunalilo is closed between Pensacola and Ernest Street. Drive normal going over to the windward side and going west. We got our usual slowdowns on both freeways.
Want to go green for your home or business? Hawaii Community Reinvestment Corporation introduces its new Green Sun Hawaii program, an innovative public-private partnership to make energy improvements affordable for everyone. Green Sun Hawaii gives you the power to significantly reduce your utility bill. Visit Hawaii National Bank or other participating lenders or one of the many authorized energy contractors for more information. Or visit greensunhawaii.com and click on the easy-to-use loan application.
Aloha. This is a solar daughter, Lena Davis. My dad, the solar guy, Jeff Davis, has been telling me to listen to him my whole life. It's helped me, and I'm sure it'll help you too. Be sure to listen to My Dad, the Solar Guy, 5 to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday on 760 KGU. Aloha.
Aloha. This is the solar guy, Jeff Davis. The solar industry has changed enormously in the last 3 years. So many companies have entered the market that one of the most asked questions I hear is, what makes your company different? Solar Services Hawaii has been serving Oahu and neighbor islands for more than 20 years. Solar Services was awarded the best inspection rate statewide from the Hot Water Rebate Program. We were number one. Solar Services is a local family company. We recognize the need for service with Aloha. I personally have given a class for the IRS. I've lectured many, including two luncheons with the National Association of Tax Preparers. Roof penetration and tax issues are my focus. For all solar products, meaning hot water, photovoltaic, pool and spa heating, solar pool pumps, solar attic fans, you name it. We specialize in photovoltaics and hot water, and of course a free estimate is available. Just call my phone, Jeff Davis the Solar Guy, at 554-7200. That's 554-7200. You have a great day and aloha.
This is Chief Louis Kealoha of the Honolulu Police Department. As part of the HPD's Safer Roads program, our officers are enforcing traffic laws 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. But we need your help. A few common sense choices can make a big difference. Stay within posted speed limits. Use a hands-free cell phone device when driving. Look out for pedestrians. And have a designated driver if you drink. Together, we can make Oahu's road safer and save lives. Aloha.
If you would like to join Jeff Davis and his guests on the air, call now at 296-5467. That's 296-5467. Now back to the Solar Guy.
You're listening to Hawaii's Tomorrow with Jeff Davis, the Solar Guy.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, filling in for Jeff Davis. With us now is Dr. John Wiltshire, director and Rachel Orange, data department manager with the Hawaii Undersea Research Laboratory at UH Manoa, or University of Manoa, also known as HURL. This program is really unique and exemplifies some of the very cool research that's happening in the deep sea. I'm so excited to have you both on the show today. So, let's start off by asking, on your website it says that you guys operate only, or two of the eight deep sea diving submersibles in the world. I mean, what's it like to be on the forefront of exploration of the deep sea?
These are tools that are very, very unique, as you said. When we say deep diving submersibles, that's anything deeper than 1,500 meters is where I got that two out of eight. There's very few operations that even can operate two submersibles at the same time. So not only are we able to dive as deep as 2,000 meters to see much of the seafloor around Hawaii, but having two of them allows us to do different types of projects that is becoming more and more valuable. Say, if you want to get really good video of something, one of the subs can be lighting up the topic while the other one is taking the images. Also, they can work in tandem and go side by side to get a really detailed survey of the seafloor, things like that.
And I imagine with such amazing technology, you've probably been able to capture some pretty amazing video. What are some of the types of things you see when you record down there?
In over 30 years of operation, we have archived over 9,000 hours of time underwater. All of that time is documented by video, and that's part of what I do is I'm in charge of these thousands and thousands of hours of video that we have archived up on campus at UH. You can see a little bit of everything down there, and one of the most remarkable things is that because we have this archive, you can go back and ask a question of the video that the original scientists may not have been asking. So, for example, we had a researcher want to look at a bunch of our old video to see if there were evidence of whales feeding in between the islands. She was looking for the specific type of indentation in the sand that would be these whales diving down and grabbing food out of the seafloor. And that wasn't the original objective of the dives, but she was able to get some information because we had that data archive.
That's amazing. And John, you've been with HURL since 1986.
That's right, 27 years.
Wow, so you've probably seen a lot of changes in those years.
Surprisingly, we had such a good handle on the technology to begin with that we've more perfected the way we operate. And as Rachel mentioned, we can operate two subs together at the same time. In fact, we are the only group now in the world that can do that because the Russian group, which could also do that, has recently laid up their submarines because of budget problems. So we, in fact, are the only group now able to put two submarines on the bottom. In fact, this has been so significant that we've had visits from the Chinese submersible groups who have now the world's deepest diving research submersible and are building a second one to be able to do exactly what we can do now.
That's unbelievable. And are you able to work with the Chinese groups as well? Or?
Yeah, we have a very good ongoing relationship with the Chinese because we are, in fact, the world's leader in a lot of this technology right now, which is amazing. For the University of Hawaii, a state university, we're the only academic group in the United States that can run two submarines. We have Woods Hole, which can run one. But because of this, the Chinese have been wanting to work with us, and we have a visiting Chinese scholar working with us now. And we had a number of delegations watching what we do so that they could learn from us, which is quite an honor for Hawaii.
Absolutely. And so have you been able to go in the submersibles?
Yes. I've been in our submersibles and some other submersibles a number of times.
And is there a particular place that has really stood out to you in your travels?
What is most amazing to me is some of the deep sea vents where you have active volcanological features on the seafloor rapidly spewing out black hot water. And when you watch these things on a video, I'm sure many of the listeners have seen National Geographic videos, you see the smoke, which is actually hot water, coming out on the seafloor. But when you're in a submersible, you can hear them and you can feel the heat. And it feels like you're in a blast furnace. And it sounds like it as well.
That sounds so cool. And are there organisms or marine species that are around these vents that you can see?
Certainly. The vent sites are the oases of the seafloor. They provide the energy that comes into the ecological environment on the seafloor. Most organisms rely on light to undergo photosynthesis and use the sun's energy for their energy system. But the other option is to use the volcanic energy in these vents. So you have fantastic undersea communities surrounding the vents.
That is really unique. I would love to see that at some point. And Rachel, have you ever been down on the submersibles as well?
I have. Actually, even before I started working for Hurl, I had done a couple of submersible dives as part of my master's research doing my degree in oceanography. And since I've been with Hurl, I've gotten to do a handful more dives. And it's really, I don't think anyone who's been in a submersible ever gets tired of it. It's a really special and fantastic and amazing experience to, as you go down and you look out your little window, watching the light disappear until you get down to the sea floor and you can only see maybe 20 feet in front of you with the lights of the submersible. And you look around, and even if it's just a muddy bottom, it feels so special and exciting to be a place that so few people get to go.
Well, and we kind of touched on this before the traffic break. We sort of talked about some of the threats that can affect the deep sea. From what you guys have seen, where do your concerns lie with anthropogenic or human impacts in the deep ocean?
I would say basically we're in a period of industrialization of the ocean. The largest industry in the ocean at the moment is the oil industry. Most people think it's either fishing or shipping, but the oil industry is much bigger than either of those. 30% of our oil and gas at the moment come from offshore. That's going to rise to 50% within 20 years. We also have huge marine minerals industries coming into the ocean, as well as fishing, of course. These are going to have a dramatic effect, and already are having a dramatic effect on the deep sea. We are seeing increased acidification, which is going to dissolve coral reefs. We're seeing increased pollution. We're seeing threats on some of the unique species that we find in the deep ocean. Many of these are not known. For instance, in our work in the Northwest Hawaiian Islands, we found 80 new species, and we've only done a large handful of dives.
Wow, and that seems to be a trend with the deep sea, is constant discovery and finding new things. And we were fortunate enough to talk a little bit about some of the fish that we find down there, but we haven't mentioned the corals. What do you guys see with corals? I mean, being dark and corals photosynthesizing, can corals even grow in the deep sea?
That's a very good question, Carly, because I think most people, being so familiar with the beautiful shallow water coral reefs that we have around Hawaii, think of them as a photosynthetic organism, when actually that's only, there's a photosynthetic algae that lives in association with the animal that's the coral. So deep sea corals don't have that relationship with the algae, and it's the animal just themselves. And there's actually a huge variety of deep sea corals. In fact, we don't even know what all is down there. That's why it's so important to be doing this kind of research. And it's you often find these deep sea corals in these huge fans up on the tops of seamounts, often in areas that have really high current environments. Sometimes talking to the submersible pilots, they'll say in some of these dives, they'll have to get the submersible set up and basically brace themselves against a rock because the current is so strong. And part of that is because in order for that coral animal to get enough food, it needs that high current to bring the food to them.
And are those corals the type of corals that we see people wearing, like coral jewelry and stuff?
Some of them are. Most people are familiar with black corals, which are one of the more shallow deep water corals. There's also gold corals and red corals that can be used for jewelry. There's several different species of each of those different types. The red corals and the gold corals are really, really deep.
And do you think that those corals that you find in the super deep environment, have you seen any changes or degradation to those reefs?
Well, you know, one interesting thing is the black corals are probably the most harvested of all the precious corals, and because they're a little bit shallower. Now we're finding there's some research that has shown there's a invasive coral that is taking over a lot of the black coral. So when you have the added pressure of a fisheries taking them out and then having this other coral taking over it, it's another pressure that we basically weren't planning for. So it's hard to tell if they will be able to sustain any further take
So long-term monitoring of these deep-sea environments are very important, and you guys do such amazing work with your submersibles. I've heard that you guys might be facing some funding cuts. Is that true?
That's certainly true. If they have the sequester next week, we will have our funding cut, and that will be the end of the program. So it is. We're very close to having massive funding problems. It just is unfortunate that the government does not see value in the kind of work that we do. And we've made all kinds of people aware of that. But as you know, it's a little difficult to work with Washington these days.
And what will happen to the submersibles?
The submersibles would be laid up if the program shuts down. Depending on what the university decides, they might or might not be sold to somebody else.
Well, let's keep our fingers crossed for you guys, and hopefully all that video data that's been archived, we can get some really cool information about an environment that's not often talked about. So thanks to both of you for being on the show today. Really appreciate you sharing your information. We're going to take a quick traffic break, and when we come back, we are going to be talking with Dr. Craig Smith. I'd like to acknowledge some of our sponsors, Hawaiian Legacy Hardwares, Tom Moffitt Productions, Island Cooling, UH Federal Credit Union, and the Manila Hotel.
KGU,
part of the Wall Street Business Network.
Had an accident on the H1 eastbound at the McCully Overpass a little while ago. It looks like it's gone now, but we have a brand new one. This one's in IAEA. It's on the H1 Epibound at the Ka'amilo Overpass. Downtown, an accident on Baratania in front of Washington Place. If you're going west from town, typical. The H1 slows about halfway down the airport viaduct. The Moanalua slows right after you go under Middle Street. No problems to the windward side or to Hawaii Kai.
Aloha, it's your solar guy, Jeff Davis, with a sure bet for you and your family. If you or someone you know believes they are living in a neighborhood that has no room on the grid to install more photovoltaics to erase your electricity bill, I can do it. I will guarantee to get your home approved by HECO, or I'll give you $100. Again, if you need PV on your home and you're under the impression that your neighborhood or your grid is full to saturation, I, Jeff Davis, the solar guy, can get your home installed and connected to HECO's net metering program, or I'll give you a $100 call-off bill. You just call me, the solar guy, Jeff Davis, at 554-7200, 554-7200. Aloha.
If you would like to contact Jeff either about the program or have any other questions about solar photovoltaics or hot water, call 554-7200. That's 554-7200.
If you would like to join Jeff Davis and his guests on the air, call now at 296-5467. That's 296-5467. Now back to the Solar Guy.
You're listening to Hawaii's Tomorrow with Jeff Davis, the Solar Guy.
Welcome back. I'm Carly Weiner, the Marine Science Gal. With us now is Dr. Craig Smith, a professor of oceanography at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. Dr. Smith is calling from the mainland. Are you there? Aloha, Dr. Craig Smith. Are you with us? Okay, well, I unfortunately can't hear you right now, so we're going to come back to your call in just a minute, and let's continue talking. Let's, if we can get all our speakers today to chime in. We've been talking about deep sea research. Oh, and I think we have Dr. Craig Smith back with us. Are you here? Nope. Okay. Well, we'll move on because we're live. So, guys, we've talked about the importance of deep sea research. We've talked about how unique this environment is, and we've talked about some of the threats. What research or changes in the technology do you see happening in the next few years with this environment?
This is Jeff Drazen here. There's a number of advances in technology. I think that one of the newest that's garnering a lot of attention within the scientific community is that of deep sea observatories. So one of the one of the advantages of an observatory is that you can place a number of instruments to sample the deep sea, and you can continuously supply power to them because these structures have a cable to some landmass. And they also allow you then to monitor your data stream in real time and to change things in real time as well. We have one such observatory here. We have the world's deepest observatory here in Hawaii. It's at 4,800 meters depth on the Abyssal Plain north of Oahu.
Amazing. And I'm going to try one last time. Dr. Craig Smith, are you here with us?
Yes, I am.
Oh, yay, finally. We had some technical difficulties. Thank you so much for calling in. I wanted to chat with you a little bit about what you do in terms of your deep sea work. Can you share with our listeners a little bit about what you study?
Well, we're particularly interested in the biodiversity of the deep sea and how broadly the species are distributed that live there. Turns out that if you go to any single spot on the deep sea floor, you find a huge diversity of animals. But we don't know if these same animals are distributed throughout the ocean at one depth or whether they're restricted to much smaller spatial scales.
So are you studying some of the deep sea animals just in Hawaii? Or are you looking across the Pacific Ocean? Or where's your scale for this connectivity work?
Well, we're actually looking at a variety of scales. One area we're looking is in the abyssal seafloor, about 6,000 meters down and off Hawaii, but then all the way across the Pacific into areas that are targeted for mining of manganese nodules. And it's really important to know whether the animals that live in an area targeted for nodule mining are also distributed other areas. That's really important to understand whether or not they're going to go extinct from strip mining of the ocean floor.
And so you say deep sea mining, but what does that have to do with the animals? How can that affect them?
Well, deep sea mining will be like mining on land. It's just like strip mining on land. They'll lower an instrument that just sucks up all kinds of sediment and all kinds of animals, and will impact areas of more than 100,000 square kilometers for 30 or 40,000 square miles for a single mining operation. So disturbing potentially disturbing huge areas of the sea floor.
And so you mentioned you're looking at species in the abyssal plain. I mean, that's pretty deep water. How do you access those areas?
Well, we access them in a couple of ways. We lower instruments from a surface ship, just giant grab samplers that we lower down, and they grab a big hunk of mud and bring it up. And we also work with what we call remotely operated vehicles. These are robotic vehicles that go on down on the end of a cable, and we can maneuver along the sea floor and watch what's going on with video and pick up animals and pick up sediment samples so that we can study them on the surface.
And so far in your work, what is the most unique or interesting thing that you've seen?
Well, another topic that we work on is the communities of animals living on dead whales on the bottom of the ocean. And I must say that the dead whale communities are probably the most unique and exciting things that we've come across. It's a whole new kind of ecosystem that was unappreciated a couple of decades ago.
That's super interesting. I don't think many people would realize that a dead whale would sink to the bottom of the ocean and create this own community. What type of things do you find on the dead whales?
Well, we find a huge diversity of animals, more than 200 species on a single dead whale fall. And some of them are worms that burrow into the bones. We call them bone-eating worms. Some of them are animals that feed on the soft tissue of the whale. And then there are other animals that have a bacterial garden that use sulfide that's oozing out of the whalebone as an energy source. So there are all many different kinds of animals.
And do you find different communities on different types of whales, like between baleen or toothed whales, or are they all the same pretty much?
Well, as far as we can tell, if it's a large enough whale, within one area you'll get a similar kind of community. But we're getting much different animals in the Antarctic where we've worked versus off Hawaii versus off the Pacific coast, Northwest Pacific coast. So it doesn't look like the species of whales are so important as much as different regions have different communities.
And do you have a particular deep-sea region you prefer to work in, or is there a favorite spot that you really find interesting?
Well, I find all of the deep-sea fascinating. It's so huge. There are so many places we haven't been. But I must confess, the sites I find most interesting at the moment are deep fjords. Fjords bring deep-sea communities right up close to the shore, and we've been studying fjords in the Antarctic and in Norway. And they are really remarkable ecosystems. Each fjord is different, and they may be very important for forming new species, despite the speciation in the deep sea.
And for those of us that haven't seen a fjord, can you give us a visual description of what one would look like?
Well, a fjord is a giant U-shaped valley carved by a glacier, and it's filled with seawater. So they're typically, I mean, some of them are more than a mile deep, and their walls are very steep. They may be only a couple of miles across. So they're just very steep, long U-shaped valleys filled with water. And some of the ones we worked in Norway are more 30 or 40 miles long and only a couple miles wide, with very deep water in the middle.
Amazing. And going back to your connectivity work that you do, how do you study the population distribution between some of these deep-sea organisms?
Well, one of the real challenges in looking at connectivity, how populations are connected across different spatial scales, is getting enough animals to really do population studies. You need to do look at their DNA sequences. And so what we're doing now to get enough animals is putting down special kinds of materials like whale bones and wood that have a specialized community that's attracted to this food-rich situation. And then we can get lots of animals, and we can look at how the populations on a wood parcel or a whale fall separated by 1,000 kilometers are related.
And so, I mean, you're saying you need a lot of species or a lot of research to be able to make any conclusions or draw these connectivity lines. What's next for you for your research in order to continue this work?
Well, we're putting out a set of experiments on the Oregon-Washington margin in the deep sea. That these are whale bones and wood falls. And then we have collaborators that are putting out experiments on the Brazil margin in the South Atlantic. So then that we can look at how the animals in different ocean basins are connected, whether they're close related or even the same species, by putting down these special kinds of experiments.
And with this research with the putting down the whale bones, is there a particular way you do that? Do you just drop them off the side of a boat, or how do you deploy those?
Well, it's actually quite complicated. What we have to do is build very specialized, what we call landers. We call them bone wood landers that have special packages of bones in a special box that opens and closes. And then these special bone woodlanders have a lot of weight on them, and they sink to the seafloor. And after 15 months, we tell a special kind of electronic piece of equipment on these landers to drop the weight, and then they float up to the surface again. So it's really complicated to set up these experiments.
And waiting 15 months to see what kind of stuff you collected, that's got to be a nail-biter in terms of anticipation.
Absolutely, yeah. It requires a lot of patience, and you're wondering for 15 months whether everything's going to work, and you hope it does. I mean, we've had a lot of success with this kind of approach in the past, but, yeah, we'll be biting our nails for 15 months, that's for sure.
And so do you have any experiments deployed currently?
No, we don't. None of these bone and wood fall experiments. We're going to deploy some very shortly off Brazil. We recovered some last year, about 8 months ago, off in Antarctica. But we don't have any down at the moment.
Wow. And Craig, before we go today, is there any final thoughts or remarks you'd like to share about your research or about the deep sea as a whole?
Yeah, well, the deep sea is just an incredible place. It actually covers most of the solid surface of the Earth, the deep sea floor. And it looks like it may be an enormous reservoir of biodiversity. It's quite conceivable that there are more species living there than, or as many as are living in tropical rainforests. But we still have had so little opportunity to sample it that we're going to find all kinds of really amazing things.
Well, thank you so much.
Okay.
Thanks so much, Dr. Smith, for being with us here today, and to all of our guests who are brave enough to explore the depths of the ocean and all these newly discovered species. I would like to also give a special shout out to Jeff Davis for inviting us to host today's program. Once again, I would like to acknowledge Hawaii's new COSI program, Island Earth, and the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. I'm Carly Weiner. Thanks for listening. Now get out there and enjoy our ocean planet.